Okay, let's let me ask you, we're going to play a little game of Do You Remember? So, do you remember when it took 5 minutes to warm up the TV? Huh? Okay, we got a few people. Do you remember when nearly everyone's mom was at home when the kids got home from school? Yeah? Do you remember when no one owned a purebred dog? do you remember when a quarter was a decent allowance? Yeah. Do you remember when you'd reach into a muddy gutter for a penny? Yeah. Now if it drops out of your hand, you just keep on walking, don't you? How about when your mom wore nylons that came in two pieces? Huh? None of that group stuff. All your male teachers wore neckties, and the female teachers had their hair done every day, and we wore high heels. Yeah? You remember some of that? You got your windshield cleaned, oil checked, gas pump without asking, and all free every time. Boy, don't you miss that today. You didn't pay for air, and you got trading stamps to boot. Do you remember when you had laundry detergent that had free glasses, dish towels, or things on inside the box? That's the way we had that's the way we had towels at our house. That's the way we had dishes to eat off of. So, we used a lot of those. Do you remember when it was considered a great privilege to be taken out to dinner at a real restaurant with your parents? Do you remember that when they threatened to keep kids back a grade if they failed, they actually did it? How about do you remember no one ever asked where the car keys were because they were always in the car, in the ignition, and the doors were never locked? I can remember that. I still do a little bit of that. In fact, I broadcast this to everybody, but that's because I can't remember where they are. So, do you remember playing baseball with no adults to help the kids with the rules of the game? Adults just complicated the process, you know? How about do you remember when being sent to the principal's office was nothing compared to the fate that awaited a student when they got home? Yeah. How about do you remember candy, cigarettes, wax, coke, shaped bottles with colored sugar water inside, soda machines that dispensed the glass bottles, coffee shops with tableside jukeboxes? How about plastic records, 8-track tapes, green stamps, mimeograph paper? Aren't you glad you came to church this evening so you could feel old, you know? Now, I don't remember any of that stuff, of course. I've seen it on the History Channels, though. But change is a part of life, and change is happening, and in fact, change is happening at a rapid pace, perhaps more rapid than it has ever happened before in human history. We may be experiencing change, you know, in just a few months with a governmental election. Our economy is changing all the time. We're having a change in our health care. We're having a change in technology all the time. You can't buy the newest gadget because as soon as you bought that one, it's already old. Because somebody has got another one to back that one up and to market it right after that. It's just impossible to do that. You know, you can take a picture of your check with your cell phone and send that picture to the bank and make a deposit now. I mean, if you don't like direct deposit, you can do it that way, and it happens. You know, we're experiencing change in the church also. And the church is probably as resistant to change as any organization that you can imagine. But yes, eventually change comes to the church. Now, whether we like it or not, all of us will find that during our lifetime, we will be forced to change, and sometimes there are times when it's necessary to change, but we find ourselves very resistant to it. You know, how many of you remember church pews? Some of you probably still go back and sit in some of those. How about when ladies wore hats to churches? You know, men wore suits and ladies wore dresses. There's a little mixture of that, but that's disappearing all the time. How about piano and organ? Still a few churches hang on to those. Hymn books. How about a deacon smoking cigarettes in between Sunday school and church? And I'm seeing it all. How do we manage change then can also affect about our quality of life but also sometimes whether we end up on the right side or the wrong side, I think, of God's will. You know, and that was true in David's time, and it's true in our time. And so if you've not been with us during this series, we've been looking at the life of David and looking at the various things that the life of David teaches us as we go through this Old Testament saint. Certainly there's more written about David in the Old Testament, or more written about David in the Bible complete, than any other possible person other than, of course, God and Jesus Christ. And so it is noteworthy for us to spend time then. If God gave us the whole story about David, He apparently wants us to learn the lessons from his life as we go through that. And so this evening we reach the point where we are having a change going on in the kingdom. You see, Saul has died here. David now, after going through those 7 long years of education that we talked about previously, now it is his turn to assume kingship. And so naturally, every time there is a change in leadership, there is going to be a change in the way that things operate, the way that things are done. What we're responsible for then is to see how we can manage those things that are change that happen to all of us. The 2 Samuel 1:11 says, "Then David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. They mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword." David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan and ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. Now, you have to hand it to David here. Remember that all that Saul had put him through up to this point. Now, we can certainly understand his love here for Jonathan and the affection that they had going on as two people. But here was Saul who had pursued David. At times he had thrown spears at David. He wanted David dead because he was jealous. He knew that David had been anointed to be the next king. And so here is David, lifting up this song. Now, the only song that I would have thought that David might have sung, certainly the song that would have come to my mind after Saul's dead, was "Ding dong, the king is dead," you know? "The king is dead, the king is dead. Ding dong, the king is dead." But that wasn't what David did here. You see, after this, we see that it was Saul, and Saul was the king. And David respected him as the king. And even though he had been pursued by him, and even though his life had been in danger at different points because of him, he still led all of Israel in the lament and song for this fallen king of Israel, of Saul. And so there is this combination of respect and enthusiasm that's going on here. Respect for that which is past, and certainly enthusiasm for that which is to come. In the church, there's an old saying, in fact, that goes something like this: methods are many, principles are few. Methods always change, principles never do. And in the church, that's a good one to follow. You know, in the church, methods must change. Methods must change in order to reach a new generation, to reach a new, different cultures, for instance, with the gospel. And that means that our time frames, our dress codes, our formats, our media and our musical expressions all are rapidly changing. And this is one of the things that is so difficult for many congregations, and this is why so many new ones sprang up, is because they have a group that's always ready for change, and then, of course, there is a group that has their foot on the brake all the time. And so a change doesn't occur, or if it does, it occurs at a very slow pace. And so the change is sometimes hard on us old-timers. You know, while it's important to enthusiastically embrace change, it's also important to do everything we can to show respect to that which is a passing in the form of church and leadership and tradition and style. If you notice that after 50 days after Jesus' death and the resurrection that happened in the New Testament, the church was born at Pentecost. The Old Testament laws, the animal sacrifices, the priesthood, the dietary restrictions no longer bound Jews who became Christians. There was this new covenant in town, and yet Paul encouraged these new Christians to be respectful of those things were in their background, in their Jewish background. In fact, we find that even though Paul writes some of the great material about all the change that is going on, still we see Paul is making his way to the feast, to be at the feast. We see that he talks in terms of not judging others in respect to those things that they are still continuing to keep. Do you know what one of the toughest jobs in the modern church is? It's not the preacher, and it's not elders or deacons. It's not any of those positions. The most difficult position in church anymore really is that of worship leader. And I'm using the term worship right now in the sense of our singing and music and our corporate assembly every week. In many, many churches, the music department is a constant battleground. I can remember when I first and I pushed for and I first introduced some of these things that are called worship choruses or worship songs today. When we first started using them, there was an outright rebellion against their use. We continued to use them, even though many of them that we were pretty selective about. We were reading right out of the Bible where they were taken from, and showing the biblical background for all of that still didn't make any difference. It was a different type of music, a different type of style, and it didn't set well with people who were used to hymn books guiding them all the way through the service. And so it is difficult. That is difficult still today. You know, we've got to appreciate how difficult it is to lead a worship service that has a huge range of people in here. We have people in here who were raised with hymnals and singing the old hymns, and there's nothing wrong with those old hymns. We also realize we got a generation of people who are sitting here this evening who are used to downloading music with their iPods and listening to that music. There is a huge challenge in bringing to us worship music. One of the things I appreciate is that we have a respect here of the music. We sing some of the older hymns from time to time, and maybe even some of the older worship songs, although I miss some of the old worship songs. They've kind of gotten jumped over with either hymns or new worship songs, it seems like. But still, it takes some talent, it takes some time to be able to put all that together. But that's only one of the things that we need to look at, you know, so that we can have music that whether you're 90 or whether you're a teenager, you can relate to the worship music that's going on. Difficult task. But that's a little small microcosm of what's going on in the church and what needs to go on church. That's one of the most noticeable, but there's so many other areas that the church needs to have to change to reach out to the culture that we're living in, and it is not an easy task to do. And some churches cannot make that kind of change or commit to any of those kind of changes. And therefore, they will find that themselves eventually that they'll be dwindling down to nothing, while others who are making those changes and are committed to changes will find that they'll be gathering some of those people in. 2 Samuel 3:39 says, "Today, though I am the anointed king, I am weak, and these sons of Zariah are too strong for me." A thing that we see here with David, and again in this passage that we're looking at here, that he managed his kingdom change with a combination of facts and faith. You know, once Saul died, certainly Judah all jumped up immediately and said, "You know, we'll follow you, David, without a doubt. You know, you're the new leader, and we'll follow you." Some of the others accepted Saul's other son, Ish-bosheth, And he had a powerful army, and he had garnered Abner as a part of that. And when these two had a falling out, Abner made peace of overtures then to David. Well, what did David do? He wisely accepted him. And because Abner could deliver on his promises to help unify the kingdom because of his many resources and people that he could touch and stuff. But David's General Joab treacherously murdered him, though, because he got jealous about that. And so David publicly rebuked Joab, and he mourned Abner. And then in a disarming display of humility, David confessed his inability to control this violent man, saying, "Today, though I am the anointed king, I am weak, and the sons of Zariah are too strong for me." You know, all leaders and all organizations have weaknesses. People know this to be true. They expect its mistakes to be made. What many people do not expect is to find a leader who is humble enough to discern those weaknesses and honest enough to admit to them. And when we are humble and honest enough to confront the brutal facts, not with a goal to blame, but with a goal to improve, then we are creating a healthy culture of change and growth for our church. You know, in his book, Good to Great, Jim Collins suggests that good to great companies embody a paradox of facts and faith. He says, unwavering faith that the company will prevail undergirds their ability to confront the brutal facts of the current reality, no matter what they are, he says. And then he says that there are three basic practices for creating a culture where the truth is heard. One of those is lead with questions, not answers. You know, the purpose of questions is to gain true understanding and not to manipulate. So you ask questions to get answers and listen to the answers. The second thing is engage dialogue and debate, not coercion. And so you want people to talk it out, but you're not suggesting that they go down the narrow route that is your route. But you want to find out what is the right route. A third thing is to conduct autopsies without blame. Sometimes some things are dead. This is true in churches especially. There are some things that are dead people are still trying to breathe life back into. They're trying to resuscitate things that are dead. And sometimes it is time to bury those things and move on to better things. And those are some difficult things and difficult decisions to make. But sometimes we have to go from things that are comfortable for us or things that we think we ought to have to things that are better things and better choices in our lives, in our own personal lives. Sometimes we need to reevaluate what's going on in our own personal lives and see what we're doing and the value of the things that are going on there. One of those people that did that was a man by the name of John Newton. And maybe you know some of his story, maybe you don't know any of his story. But in 1750, at age of 25, John Newton commanded an English slave ship. He anchored off the African coast. He purchased natives taken captive by rival tribes. The slave traders bartered to get the finest specimens. They offered alcohol and clothes and weapons to them. Newton's men took the slaves aboard. They chained them along deck into 2-foot-high pins to prevent suicides. And as many as 600 would lay side by side with like a fireplace logs, row after row. And there were no toilet facilities, there was no ventilation, and the stench in this was just indescribable. And Newton's ship had not only chains, but it had neck collars, and it had handcuffs, and it had thumb screws, and it had all sorts of torture devices. And they sailed from Africa to the Caribbean, selling the slaves for molasses and rum and other valuables. And like other captains, Newton allowed his crew to rape female slaves, as Newton did himself. Newton blasphemed God. He engaged in brutality and immorality. He prided himself in all that he did. And as a young crewman, when his ship nearly sank, though, Newton professed Christ. But he spent years committing evil before he experienced a true conversion. When he left the slave trade, he felt this increasing remorse, of course, for all that he had done during those years. And for the last half of his life, he pastored a church near London where he preached the gospel, he taught the scriptures, and eventually spoke out against the slave trade, encouraging, of course, the young parliamentarian William Wilberforce, whom we had mentioned in a few weeks back, in his battle there to outlaw slavery. But at age 82, shortly before his death, he was physically blind, but he was spiritually sighted. He said, "My memory is nearly gone, but I remember two things, that I am a great Savior, and that Christ, or that I'm a great sinner, and that Christ is a great Savior." And so on his tombstone it says, "John Newton, once an infidel, was, by the rich mercy of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, preserved, restored, pardoned, and appointed to preach the faith he had long labored to destroy." And of course he wrote hundreds of hymns, the most famous of which is the most popular song that is sung. You know the words, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound, that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see." And when you understand the story behind Newton, then you understand the words of the song then, don't you? He had to change. He found that, but it was a change that he made. He had reached a point in his life he knew that change needed to happen in his life. He might be an extreme case in this situation, but he found that there are things that he had to do. 2 Samuel 5, 4 and 5, David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years in Hebron. He reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months in Jerusalem, reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. David was 30 years old when Saul died. David became king over Judah, but he had to wait 7 more years before being recognized as the king over the rest of the nation of Israel. And how frustrating that must have been for David, knowing during this entire time period that he had been anointed first to be king, and he had to wait 7 years before Saul died. He went through that whole process, and another 7 years before he could rule over the whole nation. It must have been a source of continual frustration. At least I can imagine that it must have been. I'm not sure. I'm just putting myself in David's position and thinking, you know, and thinking, "God, when are you going to carry through with those promises that you made to me that I would be king over this nation?" And he's waiting and waiting and waiting for that to happen and to rule. But change and transition are almost always messy. It's rarely a clean, straight road. And the road of change is circuitous, it's zigzags, it's 2 steps forward, it's 1 step backwards. Change almost takes longer than the time that we estimate that it will. Why does change take so long? Change takes long because we're people. And we're imperfect, and positive change usually goes in slow, incremental steps. So what we need with each other is to be gracious, and we need to be patient in the process. You know, my mother used to put toothpicks in avocado seeds. She loved avocados. I didn't like avocados during the time that she liked avocados necessarily. I enjoy them today, but to me, I didn't. She spent some time growing up in Southern California on her grandmother's ranch out there, where avocados was one of the staples, one of the things that they had. And so every year they would send her a bunch of avocados, and I would see that after she would open it up and she'd take out that avocado seed, and she'd put some toothpicks on it, and she'd put it on a glass, you know, with water in it, and that thing would set there. And the first few times I watched that, I waited and waited and watched that thing. I thought, "What's going to happen with it? Why is she doing that?" And of course, after a while, we waited, and eventually there out sprung a root, and out was a leaf, and pretty soon the race was on, and pretty soon you had a nice little plant and growth going on to it. But during its dormant stage, was anything going on? Sure it was. Well, I just didn't see it. But for a long time, it was preparing to do what it eventually did. But change was happening. And the water was being absorbed out of the cup, and they were getting the energy from the sun, and it was doing all that stuff, and it was working eventually toward that plant. And so, yeah, change sometimes can be slow, but when it happens, it becomes a beautiful thing to us, and it becomes an enriching thing. But we need to be gentle and patient with each other. Because sometimes some of us are going through changes that we don't like, changes that are thrust upon us, changes that are uncomfortable to us, changes that cause us great personal recollections and feelings. It's not always easy when change happens to us in a personal way. And that's why we continue to need to be patient and nurture and eat one another as Christians. We don't know what's going on in other people's lives, but we can recognize sometimes that change is happening. But we not know why or how that change is happening. We might not even recognize some of the things that go in the process of change. The things that we have hooked upon, that we enjoy, or things that cause us memories, for instance, maybe. Sometimes when we change, the only thing we take with us is our memory, because we have to move on.